It's the NPR News Update for Wednesday, March 4. I'm Phil Picardi with the Minnesota News on your schedule. Coming up, more cuts, big cuts at Target. Minsky faculty and administration agree on a way forward, exempting Social Security from state taxes. A small Minnesota town will pay for the police treatment of a recent immigrant. And new immigrants compare their experiences with immigrants of old. First, Target employees have heard it before, and now more cuts are coming. Several thousand more jobs will end in the coming months, mostly at the retailer's headquarters operations in downtown Minneapolis and in Brooklyn Park. Target executives say they will cut costs by $2 billion over the next 2 years. Martin Moylan has more.
The news comes less than a month after the retailer said it would eliminate about 550 headquarters jobs in connection with the decision to shut down the company's failed Canadian operation. The retailer says the $2 billion in cuts will allow new investments to rejuvenate stores and boost sales. And Target executives say a more efficient company will mean bigger rewards for investors. A key part of the plan is a major restructuring focusing on Target's Twin Cities headquarters locations, which employ some 13,000 people. CFO John Mulligan said the goal is to create a more simple and nimble structure. He said it's time to ask the entire Target organization to follow the belt-tightening long imposed on stores.
The stores, they've been doing this for a long time. We've asked them to improve productivity every year. We've invested behind that. But bringing that back to the rest of our enterprise, and that is where we're primarily focused.
Target announced the cuts during a presentation Tuesday to Wall Street analysts. One analyst asked CEO Brian Cornell how Target would minimize possible disharmony and distractions that could arise among employees as the cuts play out. Cornell responded by saying that he and other executives are adamant about the need for Target to change.
We recognize it's a time of significant change and transformation at Target. We know it's going to take time, but we're going to make sure that we're very clear about the path that we're going to build to get there.
This year, Target expects to invest about $2 billion in the company, with half that money going to improve its e-commerce efforts and other technology operations. Target execs also want more efficient ways to bring products to stores and consumers. Top execs say that focus will help spur online sales growth of 40% and boost sales by 2 to 3% this year. Edward Jones retail analyst Brian Yarbrough expects the $2 billion in cuts will likely be enough.
It's very important for these people, losing your job. But I think there were too many layers of management, and this caused the company to be stale and not efficient and not nimble.
Governor Mark Dayton, whose family founded Target's predecessor, said the state will help laid-off employees find new jobs.
Oh, it's terrible tragedy for all those good Minnesotans and their families, and unfortunately the failures of Target's previous management are going to ripple down now on the heads of, we're told, a great many workers.
Target executives say they'll discuss the job cuts in more detail with employees in coming weeks and months. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
We have more on Target's decision to slash several thousand jobs. Sean Naughton worked with Target until 2007. He's now an analyst with Piper Jaffray, and he talked with Kathy Werzer this morning.
You know, are these job cuts overdue? Target's been struggling, obviously, for some time, but evidently 500 jobs isn't enough. Is that what the headline here is?
Yes, is the short answer. Consumers have really been changing the way they have been interacting with retailers by, it's a lot more now starting with your mobile phone and not necessarily the in-store experience. And Target has not adapted to this environment as quickly as they need to, and thus needs to make some pretty big organizational realignments and get more efficient, while at the same time having the flexibility to add talent back to some new key areas to support the business and to grow. So clearly, very unfortunate situation for the employees at Target that are not part of the future strategic initiatives, but do think that it was a tough decision that needed to be made.
Why not close stores, though?
Most of these cuts are coming at the corporate level. The company believes that their store operations team has been getting leaner over the years. So most of the stores out there in the U.S. today, they do think that those are positively producing assets. Target does review stores every year, and they actually do close some stores. And so that's a constant process, something that they're always looking at. But the assets they have out there today, they do feel that those are still productive.
So it looks at these smaller store concept as opposed to, say, the large Targets that we've seen built in the past few years. These smaller stores, one just opened fairly recently, Target Express in Dinkytown, that seems to work fairly well, at least at this point for Target?
Yes, interestingly, Target is definitely more focused on, you know, where consumers are going. So we're clearly seeing more consumers come back into more densely populated areas. Target had benefited from, you know, greenfielding out into what we'll call suburban sprawl, if you will, where new home developments were being put up. But we seem to have a little bit of a reversal of that trend. And so Target is really a lot more focused on putting in stores, obviously, where people are, and that is in some of these more densely populated markets out there. And so they're focused on what they call City Target. That's about 25% smaller than the typical Target store. And then they're also focused on these new, this kind of a test concept, Target Express. Those are about half the size of those City Targets. So definitely they try to keep the same look and feel that you have in a Target, but doing it in a much smaller space.
I know that you are very familiar with Target, obviously, because of your background, and I know you were probably parsing and reading the tea leaves from yesterday's announcement. Aside from the job cuts now, what are some of the other larger business objectives that you heard about yesterday that really interests you?
The biggest takeaway is they really want to lead with mobile, and they want to be the leader in shopping anywhere at any time. So to really become a channel-agnostic retailer and use mobile as their front door to Target. In addition to that, they want to focus on key categories, baby, kids, style, and wellness. And so a lot of those things have been ongoing, and they will continue to invest in those areas. And then Target really wants to become have more personalization inside of the store and localization efforts. So those are some of the big takeaways, key strategic priorities that Target is going after.
All right. Sean Naughton, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Troubles at Target, but Best Buy's outlook looking a little rosier. Best Buy has reported strong earnings growth for the most recent quarter over the same time last year. Here's Matt Sepik.
The Richfield-based electronics chain says net income rose 77% in the 3 months that included Christmas. U.S. same-store sales are up 2.8%. Wedbush Securities analyst Michael Pachter says Best Buy's cost-cutting moves are working, but competing with online-only retailers will remain a big challenge.
They're facing an inevitable headwind in the next 5 to 10 years where enough consumers will shift their purchases to the internet that they're just not going to be competitive.
Pachter says in the short term, the bankruptcy of Radio Shack is helping Best Buy. So are low gas prices because consumers have more to spend on TVs and smartphones. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Union negotiators for 3,500 Twin Cities area hospital workers say they have reached a tentative 3-year contract agreement covering 8 medical centers. Mark Zedeklik reports.
The Service Employees International Union says the proposed contract strengthens health and safety provisions that would benefit workers and patients. The union says the new contract would help limit workers' exposure to infectious agents and would address workers' rights to refuse to work in circumstances where they feel their health and safety might be at risk. The agreement also includes wage increases in each of its 3 years, along with increased tuition reimbursement and pension contributions. Union leaders say a vote on the tentative agreement is likely in the next few weeks. The agreement does not cover Alina hospitals where negotiations are ongoing. Mark Zedeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Faculty union leaders have agreed to rejoin efforts to overhaul the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities system, ending their months-long dispute with system leaders. Higher ed reporter Alex Friedrich talked with Kathy this morning about the tentative agreement.
Now, Alex, this was all about a plan called Charting the Future. What is it, and why did it spark such a fight?
Well, it was designed to add some consistency and some standardization among the MinSCU colleges and universities so they can, you know, operate more efficiently and give students a smoother education. But a lot of faculty have been worried that the plan would lead to too much uniformity and centralization. They thought it might strip down education to, you know, just the basics and that would cut programs and jobs. Now, through the whole planning process, faculty and students were saying Chancellor Stephen Rosenstone wasn't listening to their ideas at all. They said he and central officials would would instead dictate how the reform process would play out, was listening to them, you know, telling them what to do. Last October, both the college and university faculty unions got fed up and quit participating altogether. Now, after things came to a head in December, they started meeting regularly with trustees to hash out their differences. Now, in January, Governor Mark Dayton intervened and, you know, warned them, hey, you know, unless you guys work things out, I'm going to withhold my funding recommendation. And what we see now is a product of that.
Okay, so how does the agreement change the way that MNSCU carries out this overhaul?
Well, it gives a lot of what faculty wanted by shifting a good amount of future decision-making to campuses, and then that's where faculty and students will have a much greater say. Faculty tell me that way each campus can keep its individual character, and they say local ideas and decisions are always better than ones that are made far away. But no one is really sure yet how it's all going to play out. Both sides say they haven't yet worked out who will make the final decisions on whatever reforms are proposed. And it's still unclear just what kind of role Chancellor Rosenstone will have. One of the faculty union heads told me the reform process will probably run the way MNSCU runs now. I mean, some decisions that affect things such as curriculum will be made at the campus level, and others that affect, say, system business will be made at the central office.
Sam, curious, how much do you think Governor Dayton's warning to get it together, guys, played into this agreement?
Well, one trustee told me Dayton's got he got everyone's attention when he withheld the money. But House Higher Education Committee Chairman Bud Nornes said a resolution probably would have happened anyway. He said he'd gotten assurances from the chancellor and union officials that they'd get the job done. But he said it's good not to have this dispute hanging over his higher education committee. Still, Dayton says the hard work isn't over and that the question is going to be how they'll work together in the months ahead.
I'm curious about this, too. As you know, the faculty took votes of no confidence in Rosenstone.
Right, and those
year.
And those still stand.
Yeah, so what's the relationship between faculty members and Rosenstone?
Well, they say it's improved, probably still strained, but they're trying to patch things up.
All right, we'll talk to you later.
Thanks.
The U.S. House has voted to fund the Department of Homeland Security for the rest of the year with no strings attached. That after Republican leaders considered tying the funding bill to reversing President Obama's actions on immigration. Minnesota GOP Congressman Tom Emmer, this is first year in office, says it was a bad strategy to try to tie immigration to Homeland Security funding.
You don't hold American safety hostage, especially coming from a state with the Mall of America. You just don't do that.
Emmer says court decisions are already forcing a delay in the president's plan to halt deportations for some people in the country illegally. He says Republicans should focus on what's good for the economy. Governor Mark Dayton is scheduled to lead a trade mission to Mexico later this summer. Tom Scheck reports.
A spokesman for Governor Dayton said the trade mission will take place in August, but couldn't provide any other details. He also said it will be the governor's only trade mission this year. Dayton's last trade trip was in 2013 when he visited Norway, Sweden, and Germany. He has also led delegations to China, Japan, and South Korea. The goal of every trade mission is to increase state exports and attract direct foreign investment to Minnesota. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minnesota House Republicans went to work Tuesday on their pledge to give back to taxpayers a majority of the state's nearly $1.9 billion budget surplus. Members of the House Tax Committee debated several Republican-backed bills to exempt Social Security income from state taxes. Tim Pugmire reports.
There are five similar House bills to phase out the taxes senior citizens pay on their Social Security income. Republican Representative Kathy Lohmer of Stillwater said her bill would help keep retirees from leaving Minnesota.
These same people who've lived here all their lives, raised families, been productive and valuable members of their communities, are now having to choose to leave neighbors, friends, children, and grandchildren because of the taxes they're being asked to pay. Whether we like it or not, it's happening. And we have, personally, our family has half a dozen friends who have already left.
Lohmer's bill would reduce the Social Security tax by 10% a year until the full exemption is reached. Republican Representative Dale Lewick of Aiken is proposing a faster five-year phase-out.
When you're sitting on a fixed income and a piece of it is Social Security, you've got nowhere to go except to start pulling things out of your budget. No longer can you do those things. And so this is an opportunity to just very rapidly, very simply, put some dollars back in our senior citizens' pockets.
Social Security benefits are already exempt from state and federal taxes if an individual's income is under $25,000. The threshold is $32,000 for married couples filing jointly. Full taxation doesn't kick in until incomes top $34,000 for individuals and $44,000 for couples. DFL Representative Diane Loeffler of Minneapolis said a majority of Minnesota senior citizens are currently not being taxed.
This bill wouldn't help them. It would help the higher income seniors who, you know, exceed that threshold and have above average earnings for a retiree.
Still, the proposed reduction could affect an estimated 381,000 tax returns in 2016. The cost to the state would grow each year. DFL Representative Ann Lencheski of Bloomington said she's open to considering the tax break, but she cautioned that its price tag is significant.
These bills will ultimately cost about $500 million a year, about $1 billion at least in lost revenue when they're fully phased in. And I think that's okay if people want to figure out how they're going to permanently cut state spending to come up with that money.
DFL Governor Mark Dayton said last month that he doesn't support the full exemption of Social Security income, but is willing to look at adjusting the current income thresholds. The bills were laid over for possible inclusion in the House omnibus tax bill. The committee also advanced a measure to exempt military retirement pay from Minnesota's income tax. The proposed tax break would be phased in over 5 years. Republican Representative Bob Detmer of Forest Lake said his bill would generate revenue from veterans retiring in Minnesota.
Those are the type of people you would like to see stay in your state and start second careers. They'll be maybe starting businesses. They'll hire other people. They're going to buy homes. They'll buy vehicles.
House Republicans are also pushing a package of tax breaks for businesses, which they included in the first bill they introduced this session. Governor Dayton's tax priority is an expansion of the state's child care credits. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
Houston County commissioners have backed away from a ban on silica sand mining in the county. Elizabeth Baer reports.
The ordinance would have made Houston County the first in Minnesota to ban the practice, but the measure did not get the votes it needed to pass. So when the county's moratorium on frac sand mining expires on Thursday, the rules will revert to the existing ordinance, which does not specifically mention silica sand. There are currently no silica sand mines in Houston County, but county officials say it's home to 9 active mines used either for construction or agricultural purposes. The move away from an all-out prohibition is a blow for critics of sand mining who have fought to keep the industry out of the county. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rochester.
For years, Latinos in the town of Gaylord have accused the local police of heavily targeting minorities for traffic and other stops. City officials disputed the allegations, but they also recently agreed to pay tens of thousands of dollars to a woman who sued the city over her treatment by police. Mark Stile reports.
The city government still denies that Gaylord police officers use race or ethnicity in determining whether to stop or question someone. But the Mexican woman who sued the city says many Latinos in town believe it's true.
Sí.
Jesus Manuela Mendoza brushes away an occasional tear as she talks about her personal experiences with law enforcement in this town 50 miles southwest of the Twin Cities. She describes in her native Spanish the events 3 years ago that led her to sue the city.
Yes,
it was March 9th, 2012 when I went to the bank, and there the policeman stopped us.
Mendoza's daughter was with her. The police were looking for her daughter because of allegations that she had used another person's name to open an account. Bank employees alerted police that she was in the drive-thru. Gaylord officers and Sibley County deputies soon arrived. They questioned and eventually arrested the daughter. She went on to plead guilty and was sentenced to 10 days in jail. But at the bank, law enforcement officials also investigated the second person in the vehicle, Jesus Manuela Mendoza. They ran her Minnesota identification card and found that it was valid. They determined there were no outstanding warrants for her arrest. Recordings of police radio communications Mendoza's attorneys provided to NPR News indicate Mendoza at that point wanted to go.
She wants to leave. She doesn't want to talk to me.
Despite her protests, a squad car took Mendoza to an interrogation room at the Gaylord police station. There, she says one officer became angry when she told him again that she had legally immigrated from Mexico.
And so he told me, did you enter the country legally? I tell him, yes, I entered in 2009 and with residency. And he said, shut up. He says, you're lying. And he again slammed the table.
Still without evidence of wrongdoing, law enforcement officials took Mendoza to her house. Without her permission, they followed her inside. After she produced her green card and other supporting documents, they finally left her alone.
I was pretty confident that there was some selective policing before this lawsuit, and this reinforces that.
Ian Bratley was part of Mendoza's American Civil Liberties Union legal team that sued the city of Gaylord and Sibley County in federal district court. The two agreed to pay $20,000 each to settle the lawsuit, but they admit no wrongdoing. Bratley says the ACLU was looking for a case like Mendoza's to take to court because of complaints that had come in. The civil rights group had also used a data practices request to get a look at ticket information and dash cam video of more than 500 traffic stops in Gaylord.
Something like 60% of the stops were of Hispanic drivers.
That in a town where Latinos account for at most a quarter of the population. In a 2008 investigation, NPR News found that Gaylord police disproportionately issued tickets to Latino drivers. Gaylord city officials have refused to answer questions about the case, but did issue a statement. It says the city settled because the cost of going to trial would have been very high. Also, that the resolution of the case provides an opportunity to move forward. The ACLU says the city has already taken some significant steps forward, including the hiring of a Hispanic police chief. But there's still a lot of bad feelings left to heal. One sore point is a recording of comments made at the jail where Mendoza's daughter was held. In audio supplied by the ACLU, a police officer refers to the inmates as monkeys and says he'd like to pull up a chair, eat popcorn, and watch them. The ACLU says the officer was referring to Hispanic jail inmates. The city does not dispute the comments were made, but says the ACLU took them out of context and they were not racially motivated. As for Jesus Manuela Mendoza, she says despite her disheartening experience with local law enforcement, she's in this country to stay. Last year, she became a U.S. citizen. Mark Stile, Minnesota Public Radio News, Gaylord.
Many of today's immigrants moved to Minnesota with few possessions and little English. In that sense, they aren't much different from the Swedish immigrants who arrived here generations ago. It's this notion that launched Story Swap. As Nikki Tondell reports, the program fosters conversations between the state's newest immigrants and the offspring of some of its earliest.
It's fourth period at Wellstone High School in Minneapolis. In the back of the room, girls chat about their weekend plans. A couple guys in the corner talk sports.
And he loves soccer in Ecuador.
68-year-old Dick Sandine and 16-year-old David Yundahara debate the game's best teams. This casual conversation is actually part of the class curriculum. They're participants in Story Swap, a collaboration between the American Swedish Institute and this international high school. In addition to sports stars, the two talk about their family's experiences as immigrants.
The place that I came from is called Santa Rosa.
David left Ecuador in 2014. Dick's father emigrated from Sweden in 1922.
One of the great things about the United States is the great variety of cultures.
Most of the school's teenage students arrived in Minnesota within the last year, speaking little or no English. Story Swap gives them a chance to practice their language skills while sharing tales of home. Omar Ali talks about life back in Somalia.
I did not have any money and had to drop out of high school, so that's why I like Minnesota. Now I'm looking at a good future.
Swedish-American volunteer Joanne Swanson is paired with Omar.
You're very focused in order to getting a good education.
When she compliments him, he blushes and covers his face with his hand. School principal Amy Fearing sees many kids who are challenged by their ascribed social status, that of new immigrant.
Their language barrier, cultural differences, the way they look, they dress, they're just so self-removed.
Story Swap, says Fearing, teaches these new Americans about the lives of past immigrants, like the Swedes.
Part of our responsibility in education is to connect them with the community and say, no, there have been people before you that have come who are refugees, who are immigrants, and they've been able to keep their own culture and their own language alive, but they've also been able to move forward.
No, these are your sisters who are still in Ethiopia.
We send them money.
16-year-old Shukri Ahmed shares her first impressions of America with Chris Lane, a retired elementary school teacher.
I have been learning all sorts of things. How she came to America and had never seen a white person before and was quite scared.
This fear of the unknown is a common denominator among immigrants, from the Scandinavians who arrived in the late 1800s to the East Africans resettling in the Twin Cities today.
We have sambusa and basmati rice.
The cultural exchange stretches into the lunch hour. A buffet table offers popular foods from students' home countries. One question dominates the dining room. How do you eat a tamale?
I never see before.
Many of the Asian and African students, as well as the Swedish elders, simply stared at their tamales, perplexed by the corn husk wrapping. Eventually, a Mexican-American student came to the rescue.
I've been learning a lot about some cultures I didn't really know anything about.
Terry Carlson's great-grandparents left Sweden, bringing only what they could fit into a single wooden trunk. To 16-year-old Alberto Diaz Vazquez, that sounded a lot like his experience, coming to the United States with only what he could cram into a backpack.
It's kind of difficult.
Teacher Joyce Vanderschuren says the Story Swap program is about discovering such commonalities.
It's a fantastic experience for my students to see that other immigrants went through the same struggles that they have gone through.
And hopefully, says Vanderschuren, the success of past immigrants can be an inspiration to the newest ones. Nikki Tundell, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
That's the NPR News Update for Wednesday. I'm Phil Picardi. I'll be back with the Thursday news on the podcast. We'll